You're listening to the Reinvest Podcast, where each Tuesday we will show you how to reclaim, reconnect, and refocus your life by bringing you the top real estate professionals in the industry. We'll pull back the curtain so you can implement these tools and tactics to build generational wealth. Your hosts, Garrett Gatton and Seth Simonillo. Hey guys, welcome to episode 70 of the Reinvest Podcast. We are in the studio on the mic. Got a great episode coming to you today. Something fresh and a guest in a topic that we've never really covered before. So today we're going to get into the realm of title work and specifically in the commercial realm. So Seth, intro our guest for us.
Today we have Greg Schack. Greg, how you doing?
I'm doing fantastic, gentlemen. Appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, it's good to have you. So Greg works for a title company, and where are you based out of and what's it called?
Yeah, so I work for Northwest Title. Specifically, I lead commercial services for our Northwest commercial team. We are headquartered based out of Columbus, but we have offices all throughout the Ohio and essentially the Midwest region. And then, you know, because commercial services can be done nationwide, and the last couple months I've done deals from New Jersey down to Florida, over to Arizona, up to Michigan, everywhere in between. So
you kind of have the benefit of throwing like commercial title in there. It's kind of like the difference between a real estate agent and a commercial broker. So you're kind of a big deal.
I don't know that we should be putting down residential real estate agents
because I am one. We are one. But I'm just saying commercial title agent sounds cool. And to be honest with you, in Lima, our market is it's smaller that it doesn't necessarily demand can't support having a commercial title agent, which is why I'm excited to have you on today, because we do have a lot of commercial clientele, investment grade properties, and the topic's going to be relevant, but maybe somebody listening to this episode may not have access to this kind of expertise. So, I'm just putting two and two together. We have a Northwest Title in Lima. It's a residential one. Amanda.
Yeah.
Is that associated with you?
I don't know.
I don't think there is an association. It may just be commonly named. Yeah.
Well, there's some names.
We are in Northwest Ohio, so they just stole that name.
Yeah, it's pretty common. It's pretty common. So, Greg, give us a little background, kind of the origin story to what did you do before you worked at Northwest? What's been your involvement, your touch point, your on-ramp into real estate?
And why did you even get into title?
Yeah, those are all great questions. I actually did systems engineering in undergrad and went to law school to become a licensed patent attorney. I wanted to be around innovation and new inventions, and I saw through that. But in law school, I realized, patent attorneys just sit at a desk and read other people's creativity, and I wanted to kind of be involved in the creative process a little bit more. So I do some stuff entrepreneurial on the side, but I fell in love with real estate and doing stuff around real estate law. And title was an interesting avenue for a couple of reasons. One, it was coming out of 07, 08. So there was a lot more like title litigation that, you had these disputes and everybody thinks of like, why do I need a title insurance policy? Like I saw all the claims that justified the need for a title insurance policy, instances where, they talk about pre-start construction as this huge liability risk. And it's because, if you bring any, if you do any work or bring any materials to a site before the mortgage gets filed, you could essentially like create a lien priority risk. And projects that went belly up, you had a ton of lawsuits around whether or not, somebody had a lien priority compared to the contractors that serviced the work. So that type of stuff I got to see. I saw all sorts of things that created title like disputes. I'm not a litigant by my nature. I'd rather see a transaction come together. So as the market started to pick up, there's an affiliated law title company with that law firm. And I started leading those operations, and the rest kind of became history. So I just ramping up more and more from there.
Isn't it kind of interesting? The music's good and everything's going good until it's not.
Yeah.
And I would be interested to see some statistics of the increase of litigation that happened during and post 2008, 2009.
Yeah, claims are essentially like counter-cyclical. So market's going good, you're not going to see many claims because either there's enough money to kind of justify and things go up, but once sort of the water comes back in, then that's when you kind of see issues that people like either had latent or people start disputing about risks that would have otherwise just been kind of cast aside.
With this last year of interest rates rapidly rising. Have you, and you know, some property owners have been in trouble and have gone belly up. Have you seen an uptick in litigations for stuff like that?
So the one thing I can say is, like, I like to pride ourselves in being like a preventative maintenance resource that, you know, good title services, especially with that kind of line of sight, is how do you do the certain risk assessments to avoid that coming to fruition? Now, there is like all sorts of consolidation within the title community. I mean, residential refinance title companies are really hard to stay afloat when residential refis have gone pretty much down to zero. Now, we're balanced with acquisitions and commercial. We do have a huge residential arm to kind of round out our commercial services. So we're fortunate in that way. But I mean, I see in my developments way more risks of overruns where original construction budgets were.
Oh, yeah.
You might as well throw that pro forma out the window. So then people need to figure out how they're going to go get financing to finish their job.
Yeah.
Or do they need to bring extra equity in the project, and how do they navigate that situation?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of variables, that, you know, people had to navigate through COVID and then are navigating now. And some of these are delayed, metrics. You know, there has to be some bleed before you kind of see some of this stuff happen. But I like what you said though about preventative maintenance. I think when investors think about title work, it's kind of the last thing that happens in a transaction right before the closing. And it's very anecdotal. It's just like the bookkeeping, paper shuffling side of things. And as long as the title comes back clean, great. I'm going to wire the money. I buy the property. But it's actually a huge, important aspect of the real estate transaction, especially in commercial. So maybe kind of delineate the difference between commercial title versus what people would associate residential title work with.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't want to make too distinct of a difference, because title work is still title work. You're still assessing the legal rights, but the approach is going to be like fundamentally different from a commercial. Like, if somebody's doing it for investment purposes, if they're doing it for redevelopment, there's a whole host of like additional risks that you're inheriting when it comes to those types of transactions. So I like to think of it as like, if you're dealing with a residential title operation, like the goal is to almost turn it into like a car manufacturing factory. Like, it's an assembly line of how am I creating these title products and pushing them out and getting the closing services done. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot like just pumping out, you know, 1,000 Honda cars every day. Now, when you're talking about like commercial services, one of my early advisors taught me that a commercial transaction is a lot like herding cats. Like, you don't know which one's going to go astray, but you got to figure out how to bring it back. Said like a different way, I like to think of it in that car manufacturing thing, is it's like, I mean, I've done deals that are six-figure title policies. Like, they're effectively an exotic car that I've got to make sure I fine-tune.
Now, when you say six-figure title policy, that means the title insurance costs six figures?
Yeah, that means the actual insured amount is into the eight or nine figures.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a big policy.
That's a nut crack.
Man.
Yeah. And it's those are the ones where I like feel most at home, weirdly enough. Like, it's just the numbers start to just become zeros, but you're just locked in on in those deals. Like, you know exactly what you're doing and what you need to do for your scope. But it is, it's like you get under the hood a little bit more, and how do you tweak your services to make sure like this thing is perfectly polished by the time it reaches the end consumer.
So let's get into kind of debunking some of the title insurance myths, okay? And then maybe walking through a couple other things. You know, as technology ramps up, I know we'll get into this a little bit later, but a lot of fraud is happening in and around the escrow, the title closing process. There was a transaction that I was a part of in the last few years where I was representing the seller. On the buyer side, some wire fraud happened. And lost like six figures worth of.
And it was an email scam. Like, they just sent the email and it looked convincing enough, and almost $200,000.
It was like 150 skinnies, man, just gone.
Crazy.
And that kind of stuff happens. But that's why I think this topic is so relevant. So we got to debunk some myths, because again, investors, God love us. We want to save money. We want to allocate funds in ways that are going to drive value. And sometimes title insurance feels like more of a drag, or kind of like, oh, do I really need one more type of insurance? You know. So let's go through that. We've got three that we talked about. Number one, the myth that lender's title policy is going to have some kind of protection or coverage that would extend to the owner.
Yeah. So just immediately false. So a lender's title policy just says in it who the insured is, and it's going to only identify the lender, their successors, or assigned. So
but I think the thinking, though, is like, well, the lender's got a vested interest in the property, and by them having some coverage, there's like, isn't that the train of thought?
It's almost some phantom protection because they're involved.
So when you think of a mortgage, like so I teach the construction contracts and claims course at OSU, and we were just talking about real property rights the other day. And it's, you know, you think of it like a bundle of sticks, and you have these like rights as a property owner. And one of those rights is the right to dispose of the property. You have the free right to sell, grant an asset when you own it. So that's like the fundamental right that a mortgage is encumbering, is your ability to turn around and sell the property. So the lender is only effectively getting coverage as to that right. So they would assert the types of claims an owner would have only in the event of a foreclosure. So what they're really getting protection under in their loan policy is that I'm in first lien position and that I have a valid mortgage in the event that I need to exercise it for foreclosure. So their scope of coverage under their loan policy is specifically designated into that legal right. Now, if I'm an owner, it might give me some signs of what's in there. But if there's anything that relates to a risk assessment, it's going to be completely different from the risks you might consider as an owner.
Yeah, because the thought of like, well, they don't want me to lose the property because they don't want the real estate back. They've got their protection. You're on your own, buddy.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe this is a little too... I always want to do what the person that's doing a $30 million deal is willing to do. And we have these transactions where people get construction loans. So they've already acquired the property. They already own the land, but they're getting like a large $30, $40 million loan for their eventual development on the site. We will ask them, you know, are you interested in getting owner's policy coverage up to that loan amount or essentially the as improved value? Mm-hmm. And I would say 9 times out of 10, usually probably closer to 10 times out of 10, that they will elect to do that because they understand that, like, in the event of a complete loss, let's say an easement got missed somewhere or like a prior owner granted somebody an interest, but it never showed up in the public records. Those are the types of risks a title insurance policy is covering against, mm-hmm. that you wouldn't get any type of benefit. And a lender might not even have an actual loss in some of those situations where an owner could have a complete failure of title. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Wow. So those are the types of situations where it's just, I understand it. And the key thing to know is like the rate rules in Ohio, it's all statutorily mandated. So you can't really like shop pricing, but you can get what they call like a simultaneous issuance rate. So as you get an owner's policy, your loan policy goes down to $100. So the owner's policy is a little bit higher price point because it's covering a little bit more, but you're effectively, it's not like you're getting double charged the same fee. It's a relatively nominal comparison.
So I like how you really cut to the quick there. That myth debunked. Lender's title policy does not cover you as an owner. And so just get that out of your mind. Thank you for that one. Number two, we talked about the difference. So maybe this is the myth. Getting an attorney opinion letter as a substitute for title insurance.
Yeah, attorney opinion letter is what they call like title search reports, where just essentially like an overview of the exam. They're basically informational type things.
And the cost is less.
Cost is going to be substantially less, but the main fundamental difference to keep in mind is that there is absolutely no indemnification rights that you have.
What
in
do you
Ohio
mean by
law.
That?
So when you think of like an indemnification, like there is an insurer on a title insurance policy that is willing to step into your shoes to essentially verify your extent of ownership as they've insured under that policy.
So the attorney opinion letter, the review, something goes wrong, okay? And the owner holds this up and said, hey, I got this review. And he looks to the attorney and he says, you missed something. And the attorney's like, oops.
Yeah.
There's no recourse.
Professional negligence when it comes to that type of stuff has a completely tighter standard. Mm. So your ability to go and like recover in any way. And most of the times when you're dealing with a title insurance claim, we talked about them being counter-cyclical. They happen in bad markets, not in good markets. So if a claim were to pop up 5 years from now, you might be out of the statutory period to be able to enforce anything.
Right, right.
So you kind of lose some of those indemnification rights. And like a lot of people, when they think of insurance, like it's common to think of like risks that will pop up in the future. But what an insurance, the title insurance policy is actually insuring is your period of ownership as of the effective date, all the way back through history. So how good the search standards are matters, you know, for both products, but it's essentially like an extra layer of coverage, regardless of how good those search standards are, because you have this kind of assurance that you're insured going backwards.
So here's a question. I were to come to you with a commercial transaction and I say, Greg, I just want an opinion letter from you guys versus title insurance. Would you do it?
So we have, but I will always at least tell people, you know, this is what I recommend. Now, I can't give legal advice, but essentially what I would give them the pros and cons of both directions.
So you can do this. You're an idiot, but you can do it and I'll do it for you. My words, not yours.
Yeah. I usually am not so crass, but I'll at least be like, you know, this is where you could eventually, and sometimes we'll even have something written in writing that they'll essentially certify.
As a waiver. We told you kind of the risks of doing this. And
would there ever be a situation where you'd feel comfortable with someone not getting title insurance?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Here's what I'll say. Any property I will ever buy from this point forward, I will get title insurance. The effective value of what you're paying towards that policy is really negligible to the risk of loss that you could otherwise inherit.
So is there any, I'm just thinking on the other end of this thing, okay, we're talking about someone's buying a property. Mm-hmm. If I go through, I cross my T's, dot my I's, I get some title insurance on the property that I'm purchasing.
Yep.
Is there any advantage then when you go to sell the property? Does it make it more marketable? Is there cost that can be passed on or recouped?
Yeah, all good questions. So I, like in Ohio, Central Ohio specifically, you know, most contracts say that the seller pays for title insurance, which seems counterintuitive since the buyer is getting the insurance policy. But what the title insurance is actually insuring is your warranties of title. Like this is what you're saying. I have marketability type of title against all of these other things that prior owners have done or what I've done while I own the property. So if anybody throughout history has granted any legal right out from the property, that should be memorialized in the public record. And that sort of makes its way into the title policy. So you're warranting exactly what that status is when you're making a conveyance, which is an extra layer of assurance from the sell side. And then you're also, what you're effectively doing is creating what they call a reissue rate. So it's, as long as you have this existing policy, if you go to sell it within the next 10 years, you do get like a 30% discount or some type of steep discount for what the next policy will get issued at. Mm-hmm. So keeping it available, you can use it as due diligence to not have to like research the entire property again. So you can save on those search costs a second time. There's a lot of people who just by good record keeping of their title records can, you know, benefit from it.
Yeah.
But to be fair, like, I mean, I've seen people who are doing assemblages for properties and, you know, they didn't get title insurance for their initial stuff. And then you know, they're looking to do a development. And I'm like, well, you had a 40-year search. We should really go back 100 years. And you go back and you find oil and gas leases or you find, you know, easements or certain things that can affect the development. And
well, and so in the development conversation, you're not talking about like I'm buying the real estate with a building on it. I'm paying market rate for land and then I'm going to go go develop this and push the value. You know, you said $30 million construction loan.
I mean, it's all over the place. Whether it's $2 million or $30 million or $100 million, you're inheriting the same risks of whether or not the original due diligence at the time of acquisition gives you enough line of sight into what the full development might be.
So this would kind of segue into our third one, all right? So I think people can wrap their head around, okay, big dollar, big ticket transactions. I can understand the prudence of having title insurance. Maybe there's other investor capital into that project because it's such a large scale thing. So I don't want to gamble with their money. So then the third myth is cheaper properties don't need title insurance.
Yeah.
Let me guess. That's you're going to say no.
Here's what I'll say to not just come out so aggressively. A title issue could exist on any given property. I've had very marketable sites in the heart of downtown Columbus that were high valued, high ticket properties that had 99 year leases on it, that had these crazy terms and conditions, that had, leases that could be renewable forever. And essentially the lease was created in the 1800s. And now today, somebody that owned that lease could only pay $1,000 a year. And the property, the market rate for it. Yeah, it was crazy. So the value of the property doesn't mean that you're immune from potential title risks, but a lot of the lower value properties that I've seen are the ones where you tend to see more, I'm just going to say, maybe less diligent management of their title and legal rights during their period of ownership, that, maybe they weren't intentionally negligent, but they just didn't do the research themselves. And I have an example of a property that was probably only a couple hundred thousand, and it was a family, had it for generations, and partway through their period of ownership, they had broken it up into all these fractional interests. A bunch of different family members had a 16th of an interest.
Oh, disgusting. Yeah. That's
oh my gosh. I feel bad for our title examiner when he's telling me about it, because he's got to go back and research all these different people. Yeah, what we found out is one of those people never conveyed out their interest. One of those 16 never actually went through probate, never conveyed their interest.
And you better hope that they're still married and not dead, and right? Because that can get wily.
This was three generations ago. So I had to figure out cousins of cousins who could potentially claim an interest.
Oh my God.
And all the while, the seller's looking at me and what do you mean I don't have full title? And I'm well, if the buyer wants to accept it this way, they can, but they're not going to. And that's one of those things where you again, with an attorney opinion letter or a title search report, you're not really paying for the service of clearing up those risks, where when you're working with a title agent, we do take a sense of, I always tell people, I'm the guardrails, I'm not the engine to resolving this problem.
That's a good distinction.
Help clean up your own title. But at the end of the day, I'll be good guardrails to make sure that this risk assessment gets us where we need.
Even for cheap properties, to that point, I'm about to close on an investment property next week, and it's a cheap investment property. I'm bringing $20,000 for the down payment, and my title insurance is only $300 or $330 for my title. You know what I mean? It's just kind
it's
of peace
of
mind.
Cost of doing business. Yeah,
and it's just peace of mind. Goes right into my closing costs. I don't even really think much about it. And then I just don't even have to worry if something got missed or something wasn't recorded right, 50, 60 years ago, and it comes up somehow.
And I don't want to come off as Chicken Little, the sky's falling. There's plenty of transactions that you don't run into these risks, but they've happened enough throughout my career that I'm you just never know what a seller's bringing from their title standpoint until you really get into it. And again, for the cost of doing business, title isn't the type of thing that's going to make your property exponentially more valuable, but it is the type of thing that could be a no-go decision on whether you go forward with a particular asset.
Yeah.
And people just don't necessarily understand that. Hmm.
All right. Well, we're going to jump. Real quick, I wanted to bring up some of the fraud and how you guys perceive that in the title industry, and kind of give us an update on that. People that aren't really tuned in to maybe real estate agents or title companies, you don't understand the people have been leveling up their attempts at fraud when the transfer of money is happening. So why don't you go ahead and speak on that?
Speak to it. So give us an update, but then speak to it specifically to what kind of prudence or awareness should an investor have to prevent that from happening or being, you know, in that situation?
That's both really good questions. So I guess 30,000 foot view, like we focused really on title services, and I always break a title agent into title services and escrow services. So what we're really focusing on now is escrow services. Like, mm-hmm. And when you think of escrow, it's I'm collecting documents, I'm collecting funds, I'm dispersing according to the party's instructions. So I'm a neutral intermediary acting on everybody's behalf to facilitate their intentions. So that kind of last piece of, you know, following the party's instructions has always almost been like, assume that when you get a communication, it's coming from the party that you were communicating with. But because of what we're seeing with, you know, spoof emails and phishing scams and all these things, there are fraudsters that are intercepting communications and representing as if they are a party to a transaction when they're not, which has led to a rise in fake payoff statements or fake wire instructions, that type of thing that are hitting title agencies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's up to us as part of, you know, making sure we're following people's instructions that we're, this is Northwest Title, not necessarily like industry protocol, but, you know, it's prudent for us to call somebody independently from a verified number and just get assurances that the instructions we're using to send out funds are reliable and from a verified source.
That's stressful, dude.
It's crazy. It really is. I mean, those are the types of things that, like, I mean, they weren't risks that existed before technology, but now technology is only getting better to make the incidences of fraud more.
And compounded online. With everything's moving online anyway, work from home, most communication happens online, even for a real estate transaction. I mean, it's all phone, text, email, and then you don't even meet the person the whole time through the transaction. So it's kind of made it a little bit easier for these people to impersonate or lie or kind of, you know, hide the truth of who they are.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, it all moved towards like encrypted emails, like send stuff encrypted. So you have this link you can click on, but then links became unreliable because links were almost a risk that you were then, you know, making access into somebody else who was, you know, essentially trying to extract info from you. And so then it's, I mean, the latest thing I've heard, which is crazy, is seller impersonation fraud, where if somebody owns a piece of vacant land, especially if it's vacant land, like owned in the name of a limited liability company or some type of entity, they're just presenting as if they're the seller and trying to get a listing done. They're going to want to close fast. They're going to want to move quickly. They're going to be ready to go. And I've even heard of people, you know, delivering false driver's license to represent, essentially misrepresent that they are the person that has a right to the property. And we do certain safeguards because, like, you know, you can get the tax mailing address from the auditor's website. And at least then we could send an owner occupied letter to notify somebody that, hey, we were made aware that you're of your intention to sell this investment property, and hopefully people would receive that in a good way. But it's almost weird because, like, people almost think of it as like bad customer service when you're like, what do you mean I have to verify who I am? And like, well, today's day and age, I can't help that, like, there has to be this layer of verification.
So I mean, I don't know if this maybe doesn't tie into exactly what you're talking about, but somebody can go to the courthouse and transfer property out of your name into their name. And you think that there's this like very like vigilant, you know, monitored process for that to happen. But it happened to a guy in our office. Now it was an error. They had similar names and there wasn't a middle initial. And it was his brother actually, and it got transferred into someone else's name. But the clerk of courts, I mean, there was no oversight. It just happened. So imagine
no verification.
Someone goes there and impersonates you, gets a quick claim deed into something else because they had their attorney file it. They go to list it and sell it. They have a fast and loose title company that's willing to facilitate the transaction.
Oh, yeah.
Bob's your uncle.
It's, I mean, it's crazy. I don't even think the auditors have figured out a good way to protect against that. Because I know Franklin County at least has this monitoring system now that you can get a notification when your property rights have transferred.
Oh, yeah.
But by that point, like,
they're
it's already happened.
Yeah.
I got to
you were facing. Hey, someone went ahead and bought your property, took it from you. We thought you wanted to know that.
Right. But, I mean, this is specifically the biggest risk for, like, investors, people who own vacant land, people who have non-owner occupied properties. Because if you have owner occupied, it's a little bit more challenging for people misrepresent that they're at the property. But for these, I mean, we have so many people that invest from the coasts and other areas that like, it's not uncommon for me to have communications with people from anywhere across
how,
the country.
How often do you guys kind of encounter attempted fraud at Northwest?
Oh man, it's really hard to like pin down the incidence rate, but the one thing I could say is it's rising and you can see some of it happening. It just, our industry is under attack and people are really seeing it in a way that I don't think we've dealt with before, because like two of the major underwriters, so the actual insurers that are issuing the policy, like Northwest Title is an agent representing several different underwriters. So I can use that to like understand the risk assessment across different people to help navigate, you know, certain risks. But it also means like they essentially have underwriting guidelines and insurability sort of standards that they provide. But for that, they essentially have all these agents they have across the country, plus their own direct offices. And two of the biggest ones across the entire country just got shut down because of like essentially, I don't know that it came out, but it seems like it was a lock on their data that somebody came in with some type of like hack.
Yeah, like a cyber attack.
Yeah, they essentially went under a cyber attack. Similar thing happened to two major lenders.
They hold businesses hostage for your data and make you pay them money, like ransom money.
Yeah, essentially that's what these like roll out as. I don't know if they formally announced what it was, but I mean, it's essentially like, we know that there are so many angles that people are using, you know, cyber crimes to specifically try and engage with investment real estate.
You know what you guys should do?
What's that?
You guys should get Arizona emissions insurance. I would highly recommend that.
It's funny you say that too, because we're seeing that like cyber insurance policies, unless you were like grandfathered into some of them, like they don't want to look at them anymore. You have to do some crazy due diligence to even be eligible.
So the lesson out there for investors is to verify. Mm-hmm. Make sure you're not getting scammed with your emails and especially around the time when you're closing a property. We're going to move on into our smaller pocket segment. So Greg, go ahead and tell us about one of your worst real estate deals. It could be a deal that you did personally back when you were active in some real estate investments, or it could be a deal that you were part of on the title side. What went wrong? What did you learn from it?
Yeah, I've been fortunate that I didn't have to take too many big L's on the real estate investment front. Not that just pure entrepreneurial front is a whole different conversation. I've had some L's there, but the title insurance one, there's one that stands out in mine that was just a fascinating transaction. So it wasn't my loss, but it was one that was like, took me months to navigate. The seller comes into a transaction and provides us, you know, a title policy, and they give us all this different stuff. And one of the things on it unassumingly is like this deed restrictions. So we pull everything from the public records and we're putting our stuff together. And so we're preparing our kind of commitment and title work. And I start looking through those deed restrictions just as a matter of habit to try and get a sense of, you know, what's going on. Well, this property was like essentially residential buildings that they had turned into like offices within residential units. Mm-hmm. And this owner was coming in wanting to redevelop part of it for, I think it was a shopping center, or it was a self-storage maybe. But we go into these deed restrictions, and the deed restrictions specifically say it can be for a residential property or limited commercial use. And it's like the craziest limitations. It was like a barbecue stand. It was like a gas station. Like nothing really made sense. But the office that was on it certainly didn't appear to be a conforming use.
Because it wasn't a barbecue and office.
It wasn't. It should be pumping barbecue at it. That'll get it. And then it definitely wouldn't, you know, allow for whatever that intended development was going to be. So it became a huge sticking point from the buyer side. That type of thing kind of sounds like, oh, well, let's just release it and get that thing cleared up.
Yeah.
Or there's things out there called like the Marketable Title Act that if it originated long enough ago, you might be able to like wipe it out by law. Well, neither of those two situations applied. That it essentially was a part of this common development scheme, meaning that somebody didn't create like a development plan, but they had, let's say, 13 properties that each of those 13 owners were granted this exact same restriction. So when you dive into the law on it, that essentially means all of those 12 neighboring owners had the ability to enforce that use restriction against this 13th owner. And so the buyer was like, I don't want to inherit this unless I know it can be cleared up. And it would effectively require a quiet title action to go to each of those neighboring owners. And you know, now you're potentially kicking a hornet's nest if somebody wants to try.
So real quick, hold on. You said it was a development scheme.
Essentially meaning that like when they subdivided the property, they had the same rules that they established for each, you know, subdivided parcel.
The previous owner did?
Yeah. And this was like 4 or 5 owners ago. Let's call it a 30 acre lot. And they were doing a bunch of different like small acreages off of it.
And did they do that? What was the purpose?
So apparently he wanted a barbecue stand. He really was like, one of these guys got to give me.
Yeah, he's like, out of all these lots, these 13 lots, someone should be able to do a barbecue stand.
Deed restriction says must be barbecue. Wow.
And it's one of those things that, like, again, the current owner was insured the same way we presented it to our new owner. But we at least like gave the note of what this crazy use restriction had said so that the buyer wasn't flying completely blind for what they were planning to do. And it was only after essentially doing all of this stuff and teeing this up for, you know, a potential legal action and just the whole process to even fully like assess the risk that they were able to make a determination whether they were going to go to close. The added kind of layer is like, I do a decent amount of stuff with, right now I'm a part of the legislative committee for our development association here in Central Ohio. And you know, I do a bunch with like government affairs. And so like zoning and all that, it was like in this particular development, like everything was conforming, occurring to zoning, but zoning it essentially needs to like mesh with what your use restriction rights are. Like zoning doesn't guarantee that.
Zoning is more of a blanket thing. The deed restriction is parcel specific.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
So how did the office get built on that parcel anyway? Did someone miss something or was that done before the deed restriction was put on?
So that was essentially what the prior owner had done. So he did this conversion of use and all that because he was conforming it to zoning. So I think he even had zoning approval and whatever, but didn't realize that he essentially was like running afoul from this.
Wow.
Interesting.
Development plan. So that was another one of those where I just.
So were you able to get that deed restriction release in the end after kind of working through all the legal avenues?
It's amazing what Whiteout will do. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And so I was telling somebody, so this comes up always in my like OSU course too. And they asked the similar thing like, hey, did you just like make this go away? And I'm like, well, it's not like you can go in and just like pull it. So it was an extensive process. There was this whole thing to even like go through. And there's even like a risk assessment standpoint that you start to get to with the buyer of like, all right, well, how long before these fall off because of marketable title? Like, can I roll the dice and potentially sell it 5 years from now or however long? And I don't remember exactly where it was, but I know I got in the weeds with, this is at the time where I like kind of worked with a litigation team and was like, here, this, I got one for you. This guy's really interested in taking this on. I think they ended up having to do some type of escrow or something to try and clear it up as best.
Well, and I just want to clarify too, if you're listening, we didn't get into this about a debunking a myth, but if there's a known title issue and you get title insurance, that known title issue is exempt from the title insurance policy.
So if there is a known title issue, if it shows up in your exceptions, that effectively is meaning you are taking title subject to that risk.
Gotcha.
Where like, what we do, you know, for our larger commercial deals and really any transaction, if you're an investor, like you should know what's in that sort of Schedule B of your title policy. Because if there are deed restrictions that you don't want to be there, there's usually in your contract a period of time where you can essentially say, I want this deleted or removed, and it becomes a seller's responsibility to navigate that and get it cleared. So what we do on almost every transaction, unless it's not requested or not required, is we do a pro forma policy that before you even get to close, you know exactly what you're expecting your title policy to look like.
Right. Yeah. That's good. Yeah. That's good. All right, man. We're going to go into what we call our little nugget. So this is a part of our show where you give our investors, our listeners, one practical takeaway or a piece of advice that they can implement to their businesses.
I'm going to take it a little away from title because I personally really love investment and development. You know, kind of the thing that blends into title and everything is, you know, I was always taught just make a deal where you know you're not going to lose money. And so that's the way, like, there's so many people right now looking at equity investments rather than cash flow investments and this sort of ebbing and flowing of the market. So I guess in some way this does relate to title and all your other due diligence is make sure you close the gaps on areas where you can have potential risk of loss. But we're just seeing a lot of people right now that I heard the phrase, you figure out who's skinny dipping when the tide comes up, goes out. And there's some of that that's going on in the investment community and people running up on maturity dates where debt service coverage becomes really challenging.
Yeah.
And some people are, you know, selling the lemon asset within their pool of assets so that they can cover debt service to refinance parts of their portfolio.
And that's why we talk with our listeners, you know, the three immutable laws of real estate investing. One of those is invest for cash flow, you know, secure long-term debt and have adequate cash reserves. Each one of those variables closes up a back door that could burn you, especially in an environment like this.
For sure.
Totally agree. I'm not talking to plenty of people that are like, they haven't said it, but you can just feel the tension off of them, that they're over leveraged. And it's just, I mean, that's challenging. It's really hard.
There's no easy way out of that scenario either. You know, real estate is illiquid in many ways. And so by nature, it takes time to get out of a hole that you dug, or maybe you didn't even know that you dug it, you know? I do feel for that. We were in an investment conference this last year and there were kind of the warning signs of like, it's going to be a tough year. And, and you could see that. I mean, the keynote speaker came out swinging and was just like, hey, you need to make a pivot now before it's too late. You know, don't wait to communicate with your investors. Don't wait, you know, to infuse capital. Don't wait to get to a refinance, hoping that, you know, rates are going to come down. Like do things now while you can.
Yeah. And there's almost this game of like chicken happening in the market where sellers don't want to drop on their price because, you know, it just, but then the cash flow, like doing a deal doesn't make as much sense.
Right.
And if you're approaching a maturity date, like you're essentially, there's a chance that your valuation could be
especially
that
for sellers that refinance when rates were really low and now they're looking to sell and they're like, well, I'm cash flowing, you know, all this money. And you're like, with the new debt from day one, you're negative.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? And there's not room for the upside on rents. And it's a big disconnect right now.
Well, and that's why, again, we always talk to our investors, you know, buy and hold is such a great way to go because you don't have to worry about playing the market cycle. Like the real estate market cycle is always going to be there. It's always going to do its thing. And so naturally there's going to be a dip to it. And we're starting to kind of feel that. But if you're holding for long term, you're not stressing by that because you'll participate in the upside, you know, when it changes and corrects. But hey, real quick, what has been one of the best resources for you in your, I'm going to say in your professional development?
Oh man. I'm going to go maybe a little vague, but it's been independent mentorship. I am so shocked by how many people that are way more successful than me that are willing to grab a coffee. And like, I can't tell you how many of those people that like the words they said in one conversation have reverberated throughout my entire career. And I mean, I have so many instances of that I can't even, it's hard to even wrap my head around all of
it. What was one thing that I said that changed you?
You don't need to give him a big head. He's doing okay.
That's funny. So by independent though, you mean like one-on-one, not just like I'm in a networking group. You mean one-on-one relationships.
Making a very intentional point to see if somebody will have a one-on-one conversation and come in with humility. Like I am coming in to learn. I don't know that I have much to offer, but I will try to like bridge a connection for you or do whatever to make this worthwhile for your time. Like I take that approach I honestly probably had, I hate to say, like, I almost feel bad admitting it, but it's like maybe 100 conversations or more that have been of that type.
Yeah.
And sometimes with people that are like the owner of large development firms or the people who are, you know, teaching classes at Ohio State that helped mentor me to open up those opportunities to be able to do it. And I just, I learned somewhere that you're the average of like the, what is it? The 6 or 7 people you spend the most amount of time with.
Yeah.
Well, it's really hard to get those people to like be the one person you can be kind of a mentor with. But if you can aggregate the perspective of a number of them, and again, I always try to reciprocate. I don't want to like make it seem like I'm just, you know, using their expertise, but
right.
The vast majority of them are willing to, you know, support an eager student. And that served me really well.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Mentorship has been a recurring theme for a lot of people. And I find that intriguing from the standpoint that we live in a very technological and digital age. But that personal connection seems to be irreplaceable.
Yeah. It's an industry built on trust. So there have been a lot of those where like what started as like a soft mentorship turned into business relationships.
And, yeah.
When those happen organically, like you just don't rush it. You don't go in trying to force that. But when it comes out of it, like everybody ends up better off.
I wouldn't, and I would encourage people too. Like if you approach somebody to meet and get the coffee and they turn you down or they kind of brush you off, like push through and persist. Don't just give up because, you know, there, some people are kind of testing you and watching you without even knowing it. And if it, maybe it is that person, but maybe they, you know, you need to stay at it for another 6 months before they're going to pay attention or give some of their time to see if you're serious. Or maybe it's somebody altogether different, but sometimes you have to press through that wall because high performing people, they don't just give away their time. So they either need to sense an earnestness in you or that reciprocity. And it just kind of differs from person to person. But Greg, what would it look like for somebody to kind of follow your success, get in touch with you or your company coming out of this episode?
Reach out to me directly. So email, I have a flood of them that are coming in at any given time. So I'll kind of to your point, like you reach a point that when the center of gravity kind of shifts and there's more coming in than your like outreach efforts, it becomes a little challenging to try and make sure you orchestrate all of it. So I don't respond immediately, even just for like mentorship or whatever else, stay in touch, follow up a few times and it'll hit my radar. LinkedIn's always a good way. Like I do keep a good pulse on my LinkedIn, you know, LinkedIn, Greg Shack, Northwest Commercial, Northwest Title. And then for reaching out, email, it's greg.shack, greg.shack@nwtitle.com. In terms of following my success, I'm not a big social media guy or like anything that you'll see kind of my latest updates, but if there's ever anything worthwhile, hopefully it hits your radar.
Yeah, dude. Awesome, man. Well, hey, thank you for coming on today and unfolding some of this stuff, pulling the curtain back a little bit to a topic that is so relevant, but a lot of people don't give a lot of thought to.
Yeah, totally fair.
Awesome, man. As always, excited that you joined us on another episode of the Reinvest Podcast. If this episode added to your tool belt or left you feeling inspired, go ahead and share it with a friend. Stay tuned every Tuesday for new episodes. And if you want to get in touch with us, go to our LinkedIn or Facebook profiles and shoot us a message. Move farther, reach higher, and grow deeper. See you next time.